We're in the second chapter of Daniel. We're going to get into the second chapter of Daniel and the king's dream. Now, as we've looked at the structure of the book of Daniel, it's clear that it is not just kind of patchwork, pieces here and pieces there, but it's a very well-planned, well-laid-out book that gets across exactly what the Lord wanted to get across with the book. And it starts off in this first chapter, of course, with the introduction to Daniel and the other three Hebrew children that were there, these four fellows that came out from Judah in that first deportation. Now, that says to us that this remnant is a very small remnant. Now, I'm not saying that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are the only ones who were saved in Judah at the time of its fall into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. But I am saying that there were very, very few who served God truthfully and faithfully, as witnessed Jeremiah. If you want to see the condition of Israel, Judah particularly, during that particular time, you read the book of Jeremiah and see his heartbreak and heart. He cried and wet his couch with tears over this nation. And of course, Ezekiel was one of those who came into captivity in the second deportation. And was there, of course, during spent the rest of his life, I suppose, there in captivity, and would have known Daniel. And many think there's some statements in his book that refer to Daniel, talk about him and that he knew him, and so forth. So there were others besides these four. We know at least Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and I'm sure there were others. There were some others who were true believers. But the point that God is making, one point that he's making in this first chapter, is that if you can get a handful out of a nation, you're doing pretty good. If you can get a handful to follow the Lord out of a whole nation, you're doing pretty good. Now that's one of the lessons of chapter 1. Remnants. When we talk of remnants, we're talking of very small pieces of cloth, aren't we? Compared to what was run on the mill. They run huge bolts. I don't know, how many thousands of feet they would run when they're making cloth of a particular color or type or whatever. But those little ends and pieces that won't square up, that are no good for anything else, are the remnants. Pieces, that are cut off, that are odd balls and nutty and so forth. That's generally what remnant people are thought to be by those, the regular people and so forth of any day. And so there was just a remnant saved. And God wanted some representatives down there. And of course we saw where he raised up a king, Josiah, who established a righteous period in Judah's history in which Daniel and these other boys grew up. They were children during those years. They grew up during those years. He was the leader they had to look up to during those years. And so that was very important. God was laying a foundation so that he could have a few of the kind of character it would take to stand in a heathen land during this time. And, of course, he chose Daniel to do that. Now, that's really unusual. God sometimes works a whole lifetime to bring somebody to the place where he can use them. You take Moses. Now, Moses was taken from his mother when he was 3, when he was weaned, and raised in Pharaoh's castle, became, as far as we know, before age 40, a mighty general, the historians tell us, and a great leader in Egypt. And then he began to be moved toward the people of God and saw this Egyptian beating up on a Hebrew and killed the Egyptian, hit him in the sand. And then it was found out and he had to run. He had to run for his life. And that ended the first 40 years. Second 40 years he spent down in the wilderness, herding sheep. Married, raised children down there, spent the years down there with Jethro, his father-in-law, herding sheep. Took 80 years, and then God showed him that vision we talked about a little the other day, the burning bush, and revealed himself to him and said, I want you to go down and lead my people out. Here it took him, you see, 80 years to get him ready, and he did it with Daniel in 17. Now, that's what I'm talking about. I want you to get a hold of that. Can you get a hold of that? God did it with Daniel and Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego in 17 years. They were ready to lead. They were ready to stand. They were ready to take places of leadership in the kingdom. What's the difference? Well, I don't know all the difference, but I believe that there's some reasons for some of those things. But we see in this chapter a picture of what every child of God should be like in the midst of a wicked and depraved world system in any age. This kind of Christianity today that puts you in with all the crowd and makes you like one of the gang and can't tell you from the world and all that kind of stuff is nothing to it. That's a Christian religion. It's nothing to it. It'll take you to hell. It'll take you straight to hell. That's what it'll do. Christianity, if you're going to be a Christian today, you've got to take a stand for God just like Daniel did or just like others did, Joseph and others did during different times. But you, if you stand today, you're going to have to purpose to stand, just like Daniel purposed to stand. It's not an easier time to stand. It's at least as tough a time to stand as it was for Daniel to stand. And you're going to have to rear children with backbone and character if they're going to stand when it comes their time to take their stand. So we have a picture here in this first chapter of that. Also, this group represent the Jewish remnant in the time of the Great Tribulation. Daniel and his friends represent those, the 144,000 spoken of in Revelation, that are not going to bow the knee but are going to evangelize and stand for God during the time of the Great Tribulation. And I think they are a type of that. Now, I want to quickly go over some qualities of Daniel that were brought out in this. I think it's important that we not leave this chapter without one more look at Daniel, the kind of qualities that the king wanted and the kind of qualities he found in these young men. Well, first, they were perfect physical specimens. No deformities, they must have been handsome, strong, good-looking Jewish boys. Daniel also knew how to get along with others. You know, even those who captured him, these are his captors, and you turn around and he's made a friend with them. Just like Joseph in Potiphar's house, made a friend. Then they put him in jail. First thing you know, in jail, he's running things. He's not bossing, he's a servant, but he's in charge of everything, looking after everything. Well, Daniel was that kind of fellow, and these other fellows were that kind of fellows. They knew how to take responsibility. They did their job well, and immediately they were obedient. They'd learned obedience to authority. And remember, now God's moving away from his authority being in Jerusalem to his authority being in Gentile nations, and they've got to learn to do that. All Jews have to learn to do that in this dispensation, to be under Gentile authority in this dispensation, you see. And so Daniel and they were under discipline and made friends with their captors. They didn't compromise with their captors. They didn't cut corners with their captors. But they were the kind of young men that were warm and friendly and easy to get along with and easy to work with and took instructions and didn't shrugged their shoulders, but got busy doing what they were told to do, and so they knew how to get along. Then they were brilliant. They had good minds, and And I think this is probably the hardest to understand of all the qualities of Daniel. To be so brilliant, to be such smart young men, and yet not proud of it. Hardest thing to find today is a fellow with brains that's not proud as a peacock. Usually you find a fellow that's got his IQ runs above 100. And the higher it goes, the higher his ego goes too, you know. And if he's got a pretty good brain, then he's cocky and proud of it and a smart aleck in that regard. Well, not so with these boys. They're brilliant and yet not proud of it. Humble young men. Of course, purity of heart is the thing that reached the heart of God. Their purity of heart and mind. They kept their hearts and their minds pure. They were strong and stood strong without being crybabies with a martyr's, quote, attitude. We sure having a terrible time down here in Babylon. It's awful being a Christian in these days. I just don't know how I'll stand and how I'll make it in these times. Yes, you know, it's hard being a Christian, going out and having to work on a job. Yeah, I'm a Christian. I got saved and I'm in prison. It sure is hard being a Christian in prison. Listen, it's difficult being a Christian, the right kind of Christian, anywhere. You have to take a stand. That's all. You just have to take a stand and say, this is what I am. This is where I stand. Okay? If you really are saved, if you really are born again, whether it's in the military, whether it's in school, off somewhere in school, whether it's on a job somewhere, or whatever it is, wherever it is, you just have to stand. That's all. You don't have to be a nut. You don't have to be a fool. You don't have to be crazy. You don't have to act up or act pious. Just stand and be true to God. And don't go around with a mule face saying, look what a good pious Christian I am. That's about as bad a testimony as you can have. Now, young men of faith, willing to trust God. They were willing to put their life on the line and say, we're not going to eat of the king's meat. Now, we hope that there's a way to get around having to, and they asked and they did. The Lord worked it out for them, but if he hadn't have worked it out, just like the fiery furnace, they said, we're not going to eat. It's like they said, we're not going to bend. There's some things we just are not going to do. You see, folks, I want to tell you something. Dr. Bob Seen used to say to us preacher boys, he says, if it gets too quiet around your place, start something. Get something stirred up. Stir something up. He says, good for your backbone. He said, you need an issue. You need to fight. You need a stand. You need to have something to stand opposed to. And if it gets too quiet around the place, stir up something because you need it. And these fellas were willing to take that kind of a stand, as we see in chapter 3. We get there. The three said, we won't bow down to the image of gold. You can put us in the fire furnace if you want to, but we are not fixing to bow to that heathen idol. So these were young men of faith, willing to trust God and let God take care of the responsibilities. Daniel showed the qualities of durability and dependability. In last verse of chapter 1 says, Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. And actually, he went past the first year. It just means that he went into that time. It was in the first year of King Cyrus that the decree went out for the Jews to go back to rebuild Jerusalem. And of course, Daniel was the one who made the plans for that and got that all worked up and got those things laid out with the king and all the rest of those things, very likely. Now, I just want to mention four factors that I believe must have been important in making Daniel the man he was, and the other fellows too, but particularly Daniel. One was that he undoubtedly had godly parents with a genuine testimony. He had some good examples at home. He was bound to have some good examples at home. You find here, occasionally you find somebody, maybe a man like Joseph, who may not have had such a fine example at home, or you might find some others who were great men who maybe didn't have such great examples at home, maybe like Abraham or others. But it's a rare thing to have godly children with any kind of convictions or any kind of stand that does not have genuine parents, parents who are not hypocrites. They're real people. They don't put on, they don't try to act. They're real people. The second thing I think that must have been important there was good discipline and good training in his early years. And by that, when I talk about good discipline and good training, I'm talking about things such as teaching very young children to listen to you, to sit still and listen to you. Just don't wiggle. You can't move your fingers. You can't move your toes. You can't swing your feet. You can't jiggle them. You can't do anything. You got to sit there, stone still, and listen to me. These are training things. Just you do with your children. Okay? You're going to sit there absolutely motionless and listen to what I say and then give it back to me. And I'll give it to you and you give it back to me. I'll give it to you. Maybe not first time you do this, maybe just a minute or two. And you sit there, don't you move, don't you wiggle, don't you do anything till I say you can move, till you can wiggle. See, that's learning, teaching them to be under absolute authority. That's the kind of authority they got to learn to be under. I guarantee you that. Daniel got it somewhere. He either got it home, he got it in the temple, he got it from Josiah, the king. He got it somewhere. They learned that because they practiced it when they got down there. You don't practice things that you haven't learned. They had learned to listen, to pay attention. That's why they were good students. I guarantee you, all of our students' grades would go up at least one notch if they just listened to the teachers. That's all you'd have to do is just listen in class, and your grades would go up considerably. Just listen. Listen. Control your ears. Take your mind and say, focus it on them and listen. That's the kind of discipline I'm talking about that it takes in order to train children and make children into the right kind that they ought to be. You see, they got to learn what absolute authority is and be under it and say, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, I will do that, yes, I'll do this, I'll do that, yes, yes. See, you got to learn what that is. You got to learn to be that. And no reasoning. I don't have to reason with you. Dad never has to give a reason for what he says. Never has to give a reason for what he says. If he don't want to give a reason, he has not. He doesn't have to give a reason. Mama doesn't have to give a reason. All she has to do is give her word. Some of you don't believe that. Some of you don't believe that. Even today, some of you don't believe that. Well, I don't have to answer after I have preached it as long and much as I've preached it. And some of you have practiced it in your children, and it's very obvious when it's been practiced properly. But I can guarantee you, Daniel and those fellows got some good old-fashioned discipline whenever they were growing up. And they learned to listen, to sit still, to give attention, to focus their attention, to concentrate, you see. To be successful in any area, concentration is such an important key. And concentration is a discipline. It's a discipline of mind, concentrating on things. And then godly leadership on the part of, of King Josiah. Have an example like King Josiah to look to in his youth was very important, I'm sure. And then godly instructors and tutors, even in the midst of the apostasy. After Josiah died, in those years when they were still in their training, they still undoubtedly had some godly instructors and tutors who held up the Word of God as it is indeed the Word of God. And these are the kind of conditions that Daniel and these boys grew up under that made them able to take that kind of stand and to be the kind of young man that they were. Now let's move on. God having established his young man there in Babylon, now we read in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now let's understand some things. Nebuchadnezzar was crowned king probably after Daniel got to Babylon. Nabopolassar, I never can pronounce his name, but anyway, his father passed away about that same time. And so Nebuchadnezzar, he reigned for 44 years. And that's a long reign for a king. 44 years, so he was relatively young when he took the throne, but he was a genius in the matter of government and establishing military and running a nation and running a country. He was good at those things, and so he very quickly centralized his power in himself as an absolute monarch with all powers invested in himself. And that's what we find, and that's going to be very important. Because as we move through these different nations, from Babylon to Medo-Persia to Greece to Rome, we still see some of the qualities and traits of the absolute rulers, but more and more we move toward the end where we have the military, which represents the toe in the toes of iron, which are mixed with clay. You've got iron and clay mixed. Well, that means you've got the absolute or the authority of military might, military power mixed with democracy. They won't mix. Those two things will not mix, you see. And that's the reason that they crumble, you see. And you watch. That's the reason Eastern Europe has changed. See, communism has failed. It had to fail before we could get into the Antichrist, because we don't have that kind of authority. We've got absolute authority invested in one person, like in China, Mao Zedong and the others who followed, or Stalin and some of those who followed. See, all those things, according to prophecy, have to disappear. The breaking up of Eastern Europe and all those monarchies and their absolute power and so forth. And more and more democracy, more and more people, voting, the people deciding, the people saying, until you, I guess the best example of it is England, where you've got a monarchy that really has very little power, but show, and on the other hand, controlled by the people, see? That's the kind of thing that will be going into the tribulation period. That's the kind of structure that'll be in the governments of the world. Antichrist will rule such a thing as that. See, he'll have his rule through the people, the beast from the sea, but he'll also have his control of might and power. And then in the middle of the tribulation period, he breaks his contract with the Jew and with the other, all other Gentile nations as far as his control, giving them any say in control, and he becomes absolute ruler, God, taking the place of God and establishing himself as God during the last 3.5 years of those 7 years. So we're going to see here in this king, Nebuchadnezzar, the beginning of the times of the Gentile, the purest absolute monarch, and one of the wisest, and one who built and had a great power in Babylon for many years. But notice now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, now, stop again here, because you see, Daniel came in the year that Nebuchadnezzar was crowned, and under the system of counting how many years a king was in power, you don't count the year he came into power. That goes to the one that ruled ahead of him. So that year would be claimed by his father. So if you then have two more years, the second year of his reign, you're really in the third year, well into the third year of his reign. And this event probably took place either, I personally, my feeling is, and I certainly can't prove it, that back here in this first chapter, whenever the king brought them in, you remember verse 19, the king communed with them. Among them was found none like Daniel and so forth. And he found them 10 times better than the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. So that event probably had just taken place, which would mark the end of 3 years that they've been there, because remember, they were to be there eating the king's portion for 3 years, and then they had to stand before the king. See, so some have supposed this to be a problem here with the 2 years, but it's really no problem at all, and these things probably took place very close together. Now, if Daniel was 16, 17, we're saying probably 17, then he would be about 20 here, either late, almost 20 or 20 years old at this time, when they have finished their degree in Chaldean and the history and study of the Chaldeans. But Nebuchadnezzar now dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep break from him. He just couldn't sleep at night. He was having a problem sleeping, and these dreams kept occurring. And so then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. Now notice Daniel and his fellows are not invited to this. For what reason or why they were not invited? Maybe they hadn't quite finished their year yet. And that was following this event. Or maybe for some other reason they just were not included in this. Or maybe the magicians and so forth didn't inform them so they could come. But anyway, the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac. Now, if you have a Scofield, you have a note there at the bottom that says from Daniel 2:4 to 7:28, which is the last part of chapter 7, the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic, the ancient language of Syria. And so this is the point at which the language shifts. And if you could read the Hebrew, you'd be in trouble here because you'd come to the Syriac. Although it was very close to Hebrew, yet it was different. And so they said, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. You give us the dream, we'll make you up something. We'll get you an interpretation. We're good at that interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. Now, there's a big discussion, as you read what men have to say about this, as to whether or not the king had really forgotten or was testing things, him being a new king, now getting himself established, and maybe he just didn't trust all these fellows or whatever, or, I mean, if he did remember the dream, or you can take it, because the way the language can be interpreted in either way, but I personally hold a position that the king just, it was taken from, that this was God's way of doing this thing. He didn't want him to remember because he wanted Daniel to interpret. He didn't want them to make up some interpretation. And so I personally might believe that God just took it from the mind. He couldn't remember. He maybe remembered a little bit about it, something, but it was gone. He said, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. Now, old Nebuchadnezzar was absolute authority around there, and that's exactly what would happen, and happen in a hurry. It wouldn't be tomorrow, it'd be today. They didn't get extended appeals, and all that sort of thing. It took place now. That's the way things take place in an absolute monarchy, the kind that Jesus is going to run. When he comes to, he's going to have an absolute monarchy, he's going to rule with a wrought iron. That's going to be tough on some of us. We used to softy, softy, softy. Mushy, mushy, mushy. Sweetie, sweetie, sweetie. We all get used to that, you know. You're going to have to get used to Jesus. But he's not that way. Okay? He rules with a wrought iron. And he's a different Jesus than most of these fellows preach about and talk about and sing about and everything else that they do to misrepresent him. But anyhow, that's what's going to happen. We're going to cut you in pieces. Now, he wasn't just trying to scare them. That was the common practice when they were upset. And those monarchs of those nations, they had total power and total authority. And that's what they did. They chopped them up, took their limbs apart, chopped them up, and turned their houses into dunghills. All right? But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. The king answered and said, I know of certainty that you would gain the time because you see the thing is gone from me. You're just trying to stall. You're hoping that I'll remember and maybe then tell you, and then you can go on with this thing and say, you just, no, but he said, verse 9, but if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree to you. For ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be came. In other words, until I soften up, or I'm not in an angry mood, or I repent of this action and so forth. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon earth that can show the king's matter. That's probably the only time they told the truth. There's the whole matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, or ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. That you're asking something that's impossible. Other kings, rulers, they don't ask that. And it is a rare thing that the king requires, and there is none other that can show it before the king except God, dwelling is not in flesh. For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. That's old king had a temper, you know, fiery furnace. Still going pretty good. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellow to slay them.